Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we talk about the big Avi Lewis win at last week's NDP leadership convention. On The Breach Show, explain how to save Canadian healthcare on Press Progress Sources, and look back at the repression of pro-Palestinian encampments at University of Calgary and University of Alberta in the summer of 2024 on student power. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. And this episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from an October 2020 episode, Team Advantage talked strikes, picket lines, labor boards, and more, in an episode providing an overview of labor action basics. Now, here's the show. Makes no difference where I go.
Advantage is supported by listeners like you. Independent, listener-supported media like this podcast is possible only thanks to the generous support of our listeners. If you think what we do is important, please head over to patreon.com/AlbertaAdvantage and support our work with a monthly donation.
Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today are Joel.
Hello, hello.
And Rory.
Hi.
This is a recording that we are doing ahead of time and will be releasing in the spontaneous and off chance that there is some type of labor action or strike that happens in Alberta. It's meant to basically be a resource for folks who are unfamiliar with strikes, what they are, their history, their utility, what they look like. And as such, it won't be describing the specifics of any particular strike that may or may not be happening at the time that you are listening to this episode, but we'll speak more generally about the dynamics that are at play during a strike. So I think we should start off with some really basic questions, which are, what is a strike and who and what does it involve?
So a strike is the withholding of labor by workers in order to obtain better wages or working conditions. That's kind of the definition we settled on. There's a lot of kind of leeway, but I think that basically covers most of it.
And I would say also to win any kind of gain. You know, some of the most interesting examples of collective bargaining that are happening are people fighting to win things that are not necessarily about their direct wages or their working conditions, but rather about the conditions of their communities. I know there are bargaining units in healthcare in Alberta who put on the table during bargaining that the corporate tax rate should be raised. And I think that's an example of what you might call bargaining for the common good.
Yep, strikes have been used in the past to demand political demands. Like a great example I can think of off the top of my head was in March of 1920 in Germany. The new Weimar Republic democracy was briefly overthrown by a military coup. And in response to the coup, over 10 million workers just walked off the job the next day, demanding an end to the military assault on the democracy, and the coup collapsed. So it wasn't a demand for better wages or working conditions. It was a political demand, and they used a strike to get it.
So a strike is a way to win some kind of collectively agreed upon or expressed demand, whether that is financial, social, political, any of those things. But What's key to it is that it is done, and the exercise of power to make that demand is by withdrawing your labor and saying, I am not going to work. My coworkers are not going to work. Me and all these other people are not going to work unless this demand is met.
How is it different from a lockout or other labor actions like a work to rule or a slowdown?
So a lockout is the opposite of a strike, and it is actually the temporary shutdown of a business by an employer to compel employees to accept certain conditions. So in the most traditional example of this, and it does still happen, workers will literally show up to their workplaces to find the doors locked and themselves unable to get in. And it's usually done to break unions, to break workers' spirits, and to force workers at bargaining tables to accept concessions or rollbacks.
So an example of that is the lockout at the Federated Co-op Limited Refinery in Regina. The employer locked out the union.
The thing about work to rule and slowdown is that if you look at the Canadian Labor Code, those things actually are technically strikes. A strike is any action taken by two or more employees designed to slow down or disrupt production, but they are different than what people think of when they think of the word strike. A strike is withdrawing your labor in its totality. Work to rule is where you work only to the conditions of your contract. This is a very common tactic used by teachers who often do a lot of work outside of their contract. Think supervising at lunch, running after school clubs, programs, things like that. By ceasing to do those things, you're causing a disruption to the system of your employment without actually fully shutting things down. And a slowdown is basically when you slow down or in some way sabotage the mechanisms of work. I know of a really interesting example of this is call center workers on Staten Island are so good at their jobs and they know exactly what makes the company money and what doesn't. There's a very interesting case of them in the 2000s. Someone got fired and they wanted them rehired. So they just stopped doing things that were value added and they lost the company hundreds of thousands of dollars until their coworker was hired back.
Pretty good.
Pretty cool. So looking at the strike historically, what is the basic history of the strike? When do we first see them? And when do they kind of take shape and form into the modern strike that we know today?
As we know, strikes are an enduring feature of capitalist society, but the strike has a very, very long history. We have a record of artisans under Pharaoh Ramses III walking off the job over unpaid wages 3,100 years ago. And then the records apparently mentioned that they want a pay increase as a result.
Since the Industrial Revolution, strikes are much more common as the way that capital concentrates workers into cities makes organizing strikes much easier.
So as a result of this, you basically see the growth of trade unions to organize workers to strike more effectively and to gain more leverage to bargain for better wages, working conditions, political demands. And strikes in some way seem like a normal aspect of our society, and labor unions are, you know, legally recognized institutions that have millions of members, and legal strikes are governed by, you know, very strict sets of rules. But, you know, most people are not in a union, and most people who are in a union have collective agreements that were settled without going on strike. So it is highly possible that you, and definitely most people in our society, have never been on strike and have never walked a picket line and have never even known anyone who has been on strike.
Also, in the history of strikes, they tend to follow like other big structural events. So wars tend to be a thing where a lot of strikes happen, particularly in the aftermath of war. So after World War I, around Europe and North America, there were giant waves of strikes, mostly in response to inflation, which had increased costs of living while wages had not kept up. After World War II, I think 1946 and 47 in the United States was like the highest number of strikes ever recorded in the U.S., just like massive waves of strikes. So strikes also happen when workers feel they have a lot of leverage to go on strike. So usually when unemployment is low is another time you'll see a lot of this, or any other kinds of like economic disruption. You couldn't have that, but you have like waves of strikes throughout history. So we're kind of at a low ebb of that right now.
Kate, what should people do during a strike, in particular if they're one of the workers on strike?
If you are one of the workers who is on strike, you should leave your place of employment and you should join a picket line.
Preferably the one at your work site.
Yes.
What's a picket line?
A picket line is the physical manifestation of shutting down that work site. So in a real sense, striking is just ceasing to work. So you could technically have a strike where everyone walks off the job and they all just go home. But, you know, the employer could bring in replacement workers, scabs, and also it doesn't have as much impact as having a picket line, which is basically a physical representation of that facility and that workplace being shut down. So oftentimes picket lines will prevent scabs from getting into the worksite. They can also prevent materials from getting in or out of the worksite. And they are a place also that a lot of the community and solidarity that arises during a strike is kind of created.
So yeah, seeing people walking in a line in front of the gate of a factory with signs saying on strike, local, you know, 502 or whatever, that's essentially what a picket line looks like.
And, you know, like employers do try and bring in scabs to replace the workers that are on strike. So having a picket line can be both a physical deterrent. So, you know, if it's a hard picket line where you're actually physically blocking people or supplies from going in, but you can also have a soft picket line where it's kind of a moral deterrence. You know, like there are a lot of people, even people who are not in unions, who don't consider themselves trade unionists, who, you know, if you get to a work site and there's 1,000 people there who are screaming at you that you're a bad person for going to work there, you might just go home and find a different job.
Speaking of which, if I'm a worker whose bargaining unit is not on strike but operates at the same site or the same location as striking workers, what should I do?
So you should refuse to cross picket lines. Now, that is illegal because solidarity is basically illegal in Alberta. If you are worried about the illegality of this action and you think that your union, if you are in one, is not going to support you, or you think you're going to be subject to a lot of retaliation from management, a really good way to do this is you can actually, under occupational health and safety legislation, refuse unsafe work. And what you can do is you can say the picket line, because of all the yelling and the shouting, made an unsafe work environment and I was unable to come into work. That's kind of the weaselly way of not crossing a picket line. The principled way is just be like, I respect your picket line and I'm not coming into work. But that does come with a lot more added risks. There are very, very few unions who have written into their collective bargaining agreements that they have the right to not cross other people's picket lines. And that is because, once again, solidarity is illegal in Alberta.
Generally, sympathy strikes across the country are illegal, mainly because they're very effective. Typically, you can't go on strike unless you are legally in a position to go on strike, which means you can't usually go on strike if you want to go support another union.
Fortunately, if the strike is illegal already, then in for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that sympathy strikes are very effective, but also usually illegal. So just
that is why they are illegal.
Yeah, so
huge bummer.
Can't be recommending them enough on this podcast because they're illegal. Wouldn't want to do that. Next question, Kate. If I'm not directly involved in the strike, I'm not a worker related to the site or whatever, but I want to support the workers at the site, what should I do?
You should go to the picket line and walk it with them. So when you go to a picket line, you're going to want to ask someone who the picket captain or who the line leader is. And that's the person who's in charge of the line. On picket lines, usually guests will be asked to sign in. So a record can be kept of who is actually on the line. And oftentimes, picket captains will send thank yous and stuff to people who come walk the line with people. And that can be really important because when you're on strike, you know, you're subject to a lot of hostility from your employer, the bourgeois press, maybe your conservative friends and family. So having people that you don't know who aren't related to your workplace come and say, what you're doing is amazing. You are so brave. You are all working class heroes. And I'm just here to support you is a huge morale booster. And keeping morale up on a picket line is a huge part of having a successful strike. I try to never go to a picket line empty handed, always bring food of some kind. And if a strike is being prolonged for a long length of time, oftentimes monetary donations, things like gift cards to grocery stores and stuff, contributions to the strike fund can be really, really appreciated. But when in doubt, go to a picket line, introduce yourself to the picket captain, get their number and just say, is there anything you need on this line? I always ask.
Yeah. And walking a picket line is fun. I've done it a few times now. You get to talk to people about what their specific grievances are, why they're on strike or why they're locked out. And you get to see different parts of the city and or even southern Alberta.
It can also be super helpful if you want to support the workers to contact their employer, whether by call or by email, and let them know that you support the workers that are on strike and you want them to settle their labor dispute. In the public sector, this would look like calling your MLA, emailing your MLA, and basically just saying, like, I support the workers.
was a highlight from a legacy episode of The Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this highlight from a recent episode, Desmond Cole reports live from the NDP Leadership Convention in Winnipeg last week in a series of interviews about what Abby Lewis's win and the party's left turn will mean for its future with Naomi Klein, Matthew Green, Leah Gazan, and more. Now, here's the show.
Folks, we have a result. Abby Lewis is the new leader of the New Democratic Party of Canada. It's just been announced. A decisive first ballot victory for Abby Lewis.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. And please forgive my weathered voice. It's recovering from our weekend of extensive coverage of the federal NDP leadership race in Winnipeg this past weekend. As you've probably heard, that contest was won by Abby Lewis, the journalist, filmmaker, and activist whose left populist campaign led to a strong first ballot victory. We were live in Winnipeg for Lewis's victory, and we spoke with some of his supporters about how he did it and what comes next. Here are those conversations, and as we bring them to you, please remember to like and subscribe for more journalism for transformation.
People breaking out right now, the speech is over, and so people are kind of pouring out and celebrating. There's lots of hugs and lots of joyfulness. We were able to have Leah Gazan. She's the MP for Winnipeg Centre here where we are right now. She's been an Abby Lewis supporter, and I'm going to bring her in right
now. Hello, Desmond. How are you?
I want to know how you're doing.
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. I think it's very clear we have thousands of people here in Manitoba who are sharing hope and a progressive vision that brings everybody along. Well, look, I want to lift up all the candidates. They ran dynamic campaigns, brought forward amazing ideas, centered and focused on a different agenda, but a similar agenda. And I'm looking forward to working with all of the leadership candidates as we move forward. It's no surprise I endorsed our new leader, Abby Lewis. He is strong, he's brilliant, he's dynamic, and he is ready to unite this party and bring us forward in a good way. They ran an absolutely dynamic campaign. Avi is grounded in movements. He was able to sell memberships to first-time New Democrats. He inspired young people to get involved in politics, young people who feel so left out of the political discourse because they have been left behind. Affordable housing, rent geared to income, guaranteed livable basic income, tuition debt that is leaving so many on the margins. So he is able to do that. And he is connected from movement to movement and to movement. And I think we saw that today.
Something that you and I talked about on The Breach Show a few weeks back, and something that I think is going to be an interesting theme now, is that, of course, Abby Lewis comes into this now as leader. He doesn't have a seat. And he's been being asked about that in the last week. And he has even suggested that that might not be the first thing that he worries about, that he has other priorities. So if it's not going to be focused right now on trying to find a place to run, what do you think his focus ought to be instead?
Well, first, I want to be clear. Jack Layton didn't have a seat. Okay. Jagmeet didn't have a seat. Okay, this is not the first leader that hasn't had a seat. I trust in his leadership. He is focused on the ground. He understands that the movement is bigger than him. It's about people joining together, mobilizing the masses so that we can elect more New Democrats to fight against this growing right that's being offered up by the Carney government.
Leah, thank you for everything you've given
thank
us.
Thank you, Desmond.
Another person who we've been really eager to talk to is here. You might know her as an author, political commentator, a brilliant researcher, and activist. Naomi Klein is all of those things. She is also the wife, the partner of Abby Lewis, and she's here to join us. How are you feeling right now?
Overwhelmed and so grateful. This has been such a this campaign's just been so positive. It's just grown and grown, and it has felt more like a movement than a campaign, which all the best political election campaigns do. You know, I've been lucky enough to have been part of Bernie's campaign in 2020 and done some work for Zoran Mamdani. And, you know, these moments are rare, you know, in left history. We often aren't able to go all the way. And so we really have to savor them. And so, I feel great. I feel so proud of Avi.
You mentioned Bernie Sanders in the United States of America, and definitely the similarities in messaging between a movement and a campaign like that and this one are quite clear, particularly drawing the distinction between the 99% of people and the billionaire class who have increasing control every day in our lives. I don't think there's any doubt about that. That movement did catch fire for a while in the United States, and there was a time when it looked like Bernie Sanders was going to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. He wasn't quite able to make it, but he did build a real grassroots movement.
Yeah. And a lot of us who were part of that campaign thought that he could have defeated Trump precisely because so many working class people are going over to these right wing so-called populists who are willing to talk about the pain of their lives, right? Who really recognize that the cost of living, you know, is unbearable, that the system feels really rigged, and they echo all of that. But as Abby just said in that speech, what they won't say, right, is that it's actually capitalism. It's a system of corporations and governments working together to rig it. It's working for some people, right? And so we really haven't had that for a long time of politicians who are really able to name the system itself. And I honestly think it's the only way we can bring people back.
Public ownership of grocery stores, public ownership of banks, public ownership of goods that the public needs. A huge part of this now successful leadership campaign that's going to be pitched to the Canadian public. There is, I think, a very common line of skepticism about public ownership. The faith in government is at a point in this country and in the Western world where people don't know if they can look to government for big solutions. How is he going to sell these big transformative ideas that he's pitched in this leadership race?
You know, I think one of the things that we can learn from Zoran Mamdani is he has this sort of, he moonlights as a history professor, you know, like he sees part of his work, whether he was campaigning or now that he's mayor, is actually educating people about radical history because we don't learn it in school. It's not part of our traditional education. So people in Canada generally don't know the history of public ownership in Canada, right? Which, you know, during the Second World War, all, you know, so many crown corporations were created because it was a moment that the market could not address. And we are in all of these sort of so-called market failures. The market is fine, happy to fail, right? Because that just means, it just means that people will fall. And we are in this time where we've all been kind of accustomed to mass death. And I think the genocide in Gaza, one of the roles that it played was sort of like kind of testing how much will people put up with, right? How much can people get used to, right? During COVID, there was this kind of war about, like, are we going to protect people, right? Are we going to have an attitude that everybody deserves to live through this? Or can we just kind of triage here, right? And then I think what we saw with Gaza, and this is why, you know, Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, said that the poor of the world see their future in Gaza, right, is that what we saw from liberal elites around the world, including in Canada, was a chilling willingness to live with mass death, to live with genocide. And so that's what market failure means in this moment. You know, I call it end times fascism. I think that that's what we're up against. And only a willingness to tell the truth can face that. And I think there's such a deep desire for truth-telling right now. And because our centrists and liberals have failed so spectacularly, we see people slipping into conspiracy land in all kinds of ways, right? All these right-wing grifters stepping up. Oh, suddenly they care about genocide, right? Because there's energy there, because there's so much silence there, right? So that's my hope for Avi's leadership. I think he can do that. I think he has a long track record as a communicator, right? Working in media, thinking about how do you distill ideas down to their essence on television, and also debate. You know, Avi used to host a debate show four nights a week. It was the hardest time in our lives because he was never ever home. But one of the things I think we learned in that debate format was that it was that we perform best when we actually have to fight for our ideas, right? Like, it's easy to kind of get mushy when no one's challenging us. So there's going to be a lot of debate, including inside the NDP. Canada is this society where, like, oh my God, people are disagreeing. The world is ending. We cannot. Like, there's so much panic in media culture. When, like, it's treated as a crisis. It's politics. We have disagreements. When you have a clear vision, people will disagree. It's okay. That's how democracy should function. People should be able to air out their ideas. So there's going, now that there is somebody out there going, like, I believe in something, okay? I believe that we are late to the climate crisis. You know, we've been talking about this for decades, and now we are out of time. We need to transition off of fossil fuels. And it is that, it's his conviction that they're afraid of, right? Because everyone says it, but they know he means it. And so there'll be some freakouts. Everyone stay calm. We're going to get through this. It's a good sign. It means that we're standing for something.
Finally, I want to ask you about what is perceived to be an opportunity right now, particularly on the international scene. We're witnessing Trump's debacle in Iran, going there without any reason, vision, plan, without the backing of most of the international community.
Well, they don't believe in international law. They, when they abducted Maduro, there was a coordinated messaging campaign on the right to say that international law is fake. And we heard it in symphony. You know, we heard a chorus of it, you know, all the way from Stephen Miller and Donald Trump, you know, down to like pundits like Joe Walsh, right? Mm-hmm. So what, you know, and then you have Trump creating a parallel UN, so-called Board of Peace, right? So it is a very explicit campaign to destroy the whole international post-World War II infrastructure of humanitarian law, international humanitarian law, because they're afraid of it. They are afraid of it, and you can see it in the way they treat Francesca Albanese, in the way they have sanctioned the ICC judges that, you know, have issued arrest warrants for crimes against humanity for Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant. They, and the day after Francesca Albanese put out her economy of genocide report that named the tech companies, they slapped her with sanctions. I mean, Francesca Albanese can't book a hotel room right now. All these people, like, they've lost their Gmail. Like, it's, they under, and I think on the left, we have to really pay attention to this, because international humanitarian law has been such a failure. It's so weak, right? And it's so weak because of the lack of faith in it. It's only as strong as the moral force behind it and governments acting like it matters, right? But the fact that it's such a priority for these criminals to destroy every vestige of international law shows that actually this is something that needs to be defended, and we need to live up to the promise that has never been realized, because the system was always rigged with vetoes, exemptions. The Security Council meant that the UN was never the democracy. The Security Council vetoes meant that the UN was never the democracy that it was supposed to be. But I believe that we cannot give up on the promise of a genuine universalism, which has never been a reality. But just because it's never been a reality doesn't mean we can afford to throw it out at the very moment when these criminals have such a top priority of destroying it. And that's another reason why I think it's really important that Avi has been elected NDP leader, because he's going to use the megaphone that comes with that to really be a voice for international law. Because, you know, people responded to Carney in the way that they did at Davos because they kind of thought he was saying something he wasn't saying, right? Because it sort of sounded like, oh yeah, you know, we're gonna go our own way with middle countries, and people thought, oh, they're gonna actually do it, ethical international law, but that just, he actually just meant we're gonna do a trade deal with Modi.
We could talk all afternoon. Just really quickly, you said that when, you know, Avi was on Counterspin, your life was very different. I imagine it's gonna be even more of a change for you now.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. I've just been staying busy and not thinking about the future.
Well, enjoy the moment for right now, and thank you so much for joining us today, Naomi. Come on in here, Matthew Green, former New Democrat MP for Hamilton Center, one of the spearheaders of the NDP Renewal Project that was trying to find out what happened in the last campaign and carry things forward into the future for the party. You're blinding me with your jersey. I don't know what I did to you.
There are a few places where having a jersey like this is appropriate. So every couple of years, you know, this is where it's at. We're here today. You can feel the buzz, lots of excitement. You know, you spoke a little bit about the work on renewal. Our theory of change is that there requires, I think, necessarily a deep connection, a reconnection with our membership. And I think in some regards, some of the results may have demonstrated